With a sense of amazement, and I expect you do, when it first dawned on me that so much of our universe is interdependent. Maybe it was a high school biology class, but when I first learned that we human beings take in oxygen and we give out carbon dioxide, and it just happens that the plant creation all around us is made in exactly the opposite way, so that we take in what we need from the plants, and we give off what the plants need for their own existence. There's a law of reciprocity, it seems, that goes all through the universe. Life is a life of giving and taking, or taking and giving. And that kind of balance has to apply to all of life. At the first or most basic levels, it applies involuntarily. I don't really decide I'm going to breathe. I don't even decide that I'm going to give off carbon dioxide because it will be good for the plants. It's an involuntary action. It just happens, and everything works well. But the higher we go up the scale of human actions, the more it has to be willed voluntarily when we cooperate with the balance of life, to try to make sure that we not only take in, but give out what is needed by somebody or something else. That's not the only thing that's indicated in this parable, but it is one of the lessons that can be gained from the parable. At least one of the things that went wrong in this story Jesus told was that very early in life, the prodigal boy had become a taker. He was not a giver. He was a person interested in his happiness, in his way being carried out, in whatever he wanted being fulfilled. He comes to his father and says, "Father, give me my share of the estate." Can you imagine the implications of that kind of request? It's as if the young man came to his father and said, "Old man, I wish you were dead. I wish we were at your funeral and we were divvying up your property. I want what's mine. I want out of here. I'd like life somewhere else. I don't care for life here." There was a callousness, an insensitivity about his request that had to show through. After all, in the inheritance laws of that day, the oldest child would receive a double portion. If there were only the two boys in the family, and that's all we're introduced to in the story, the younger son would take a third of the possessions. And you know that to pull one third of the resources out of any business can cripple the business. But takers are rarely carers, and what this boy wants is his own way. He's going to satisfy himself. The amazing thing is that the father complied with the request. Maybe the father was wise enough to sense the fact that the only school this boy is going to learn anything in is the school of hard knocks. That if he stays here, he won't learn. He may as well be turned loose to go and learn where he will. For whatever reason, the father gives him what he asks for. So he divided his property between them. And then we're quickly told what the boy does. Not long after that, he got together everything he had and went to a far country, or set off to a distant country. But it soon becomes obvious that the only thing the boy changes is his address. He doesn't change his way of action at all. Because when he went to the far country, there he squandered his wealth in wild living. You know, if you have a cold and you go into the other room, you don't leave the cold behind. You simply carry the germs with you. And if you have a case of selfishness, such as this boy has, you go into the distant country, but you don't begin to ask questions such as, "What are the problems here? What are the needs of this land to which I've just come? How could my gifts serve the people in this area? What is there I could do to make a contribution to the ongoing of this community?" There's nothing of that in the story. The boy only changes his address. He moves to a new area and continues to live exactly as he had lived in the past. And you know what happens. Very quickly, everything he has is gone. After he'd spent everything, there was a severe famine in the whole country. And a little later, we're told that he had so thoroughly reduced himself that verse 16 says, "No one gave him anything." Everything he has is gone. That's the way life works. If I use everything that comes to me and I don't put back into the process anything from what has been given to me, everything will collapse around me. If I take in air because I need oxygen and then decide I'll hold my breath, I'm not worried about the plants. What I want is oxygen and I've got it. If I hold my breath, it won't take but a few minutes and I'll be dead. That's just the way life is. I'm going to experience give and take, or I'm not going on with life in the physical realm. So the boy spends everything he has and he's reduced to nothing. I think that has to be the meaning when Jesus says, Matthew 16:25, the saying is repeated several times in the Gospels, whoever would save his life will lose it. Whoever will lose his life will save it. Variations of the saying, whoever will save his life will lose it. Whoever will lose his life for my sake and the Gospels will save it. But the point is, whoever will lose his life, whoever holds on to life for himself, seeks to grasp and keep everything he has and live for his own satisfaction, will certainly lose his life. Whoever is willing to lose his life for my sake, whoever is willing to pour himself out in the service of other people, to spend himself so that he may help others, that's the person who is most certain to keep life or to save it. That's the same principle we have at work here. And so the boy, who's a taker and not a giver, spends everything he has, gathers around him people who are just like himself, and consequently, when he's reduced to nothing, the whole complex of relationships he's created around him collapses. And nobody gives him anything. They've shared the same kind of life he has. They've been taking from him as long as he could give. And when he no longer has anything to give, they're gone. Nobody gives him anything. When the world collapses around him, the boy has something strange happen. He begins to remember. He remembers what his father was like. He remembers what his father's farm was like. He remembers something about his family. Back on the farm, people were not just consumers, they were producers. They didn't just take in, they gave out. And that began to have some appeal to him. Jesus says, when he came to his senses, the Greek expression for came to could be used of awakening from a coma. He literally comes to himself and realizes things weren't as bad back in the old country as I thought they were. That kind of process made more sense than I thought it did. In fact, it's the only way to live, it seems. And so he decides on a course of action. I will set out and go to my father and say to him, Father, I've sinned. A little later, I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired men. Among other things, the boy experiences shame. I've done the wrong thing. I've sinned against heaven. I've sinned against you. I've squandered what you have been wise enough to earn and to save. It's all gone, but I have learned something. I want to come back and this time be a producer and not just a consumer. I want to give and not just take. I've learned what life is like. Make me one of your hired servants. And you know how the story ends. The boy goes home. His father sees him a long way off. When he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion, ran to his son, threw his arms around him and kissed him. And the son started his prepared speech, but he was never able to finish it because the father interrupted. I don't know how the father learned what had happened, but I suspect body language told him everything he needed to know. I suspect he saw something in the boy that he'd never seen before, that he knew the boy had learned a lesson. He didn't want to hear the speech. All he wanted was to get the best robe, a ring for his finger, sandals for his feet, help him to feel at home, bring the fattened calf, have a feast, because apparently there's rejoicing all over the universe when one of us learns what life is really all about. Several times in this chapter, Jesus had said there's rejoicing among the angels of God. There's rejoicing in heaven when one sinner comes to repentance. This time, the father has to make a speech to the older brother and tell him the kind of rejoicing that ought to be taking place because this boy was dead. He's alive. He's learned what life is about. He's decided to be part of the process of give and take. He's going to give and not just take. He's home. Well, of all the applications that can be made of the parable of the prodigal son, growing up from being a taker to the place where we're willing to be givers has to be one of those lessons. I suspect that the reason the Lord made the universe the way it is, especially at the principle of reciprocity, is that that's the only way maturity ever comes. It's awfully easy, young in life, to think that all you have to do is be a taker. You never have to be a giver. But coming to maturity is coming to a realization of the fact that you have to be a giver and not just a taker. That's the way families operate. That's the way friendships operate. That's the way churches operate. It's the way a community operates, the way the world operates. When you were born into the world, when I was born into the world, everything was ready. All we had was to kick and cry and make a little disturbance, and we got whatever we wanted. And for a while in life, sometimes for all of life, we assume that that's the way to get things done. And we never really grow to the maturity of realizing that the only way things are provided for others is when we begin to assume responsibility to provide them. That's a mark of maturity. When we begin going to church, we get old enough for that. We become aware of what's been done. Somebody's already provided everything for us. The buildings are there. The teachers are there. Somebody has created a relationship in which we can nurture our spiritual lives, in which we can grow into maturity. And coming to maturity ourselves means that you and I are ready to bear part of that responsibility. All of our advertising pulls in exactly the opposite direction. The way to be happy, the tube says, is to shuck all responsibility and find your place in the sun. Go for whatever you can get as quickly as you can get it, because you deserve it. It's that kind of approach to life that helps us to stay immature, that keeps us from realizing that life is a process of giving and not simply of taking. It isn't just a matter of maturing. It's the only way we ensure the future of anything that we believe in. Christianity, this country, our quality of family life, civilization for that matter, is always within one generation of extinction. The only thing it takes to wipe it out is for all of us to decide that we're in it for all we can get, and the sooner the better, and we don't care what anybody else gets. We all become takers, and the whole situation collapses around us. There isn't anything else that can happen. That's what has to occur. The universe is built on the law of giving and taking. The church exists in two forms. We're here this morning in a concentrated form. We need this. We're taking in oxygen. Tomorrow we're going to be diffused. We're going to be breathing out carbon dioxide. Whatever we've gotten here, we're going to be sharing in one way or another, through word or deed, with people all around us. That means that while we're here in concentrated form even, we're givers and takers. That's the way we keep our life going. If you want your child to be in a Bible class, I don't believe there's any way you can guarantee it, except by saying that at some point in your life, you're willing to teach a Bible class. If you want to be the recipient of activities of committees, if you want that kind of work to go on, the only way you can guarantee it is that sometime you have to be willing to serve on a committee, including all of those long hours. If you like to be ushered in when you come a bit late and need a place to sit, the only way to guarantee that is to be willing sometime, at some point, to be an usher. We've been saying in various settings in recent weeks that if you really like to eat dinner with the whole church on Wednesday night, the only way to guarantee it is to be willing to help prepare it and to clean up the tables after it's done. That's life. It's our life as a family. At whatever level you're involved, giving and taking is part of that level. If you're only taking, you aren't really living. Fullness of life comes when you mature to the point and realize that the future of the whole enterprise you believe in depends upon your being a responsible giver and not just a taker. I suspect by now you figured why this sermon was done on this day. For several weeks, a number of people in this congregation have been dealing with the question, what is our ministry going to be like in 1982? If we could identify every person here who's had input at some level, a sizable percentage of the congregation would be identified. Every committee involving every possible committee member, has gone through what the hopes and dreams of that committee will be for 1982. Every deacon, the elders have spent hours and hours, every staff member will have been by now involved in a special way in what the plans of this congregation for next year are. And now we've come to a pretty late point in that planning process. But an important point nonetheless, where after as many people as possible have been involved, we have to say to the entire congregation, we have to know what kind of commitment you have in mind for next year. I think it's unfortunate that we reduce all of that to a very wooden word, and we call it the budget. And nobody feels very close to a budget. But what a budget is about is a ministry. And what we really are planning is what we're going to do as a people in the coming year. We've been taking in a lot of oxygen. What kind of carbon dioxide are we going to breathe out on our world? What new shapes will that ministry take in this community or in other parts of the world? And that always raises a question. I think the conscientious Christian raises it fairly regularly in our inflationary times because his own standard of living changes quite quickly. How much should I give? How much should I be involved in this? You know the reluctance of anyone to tell you a precise percentage and to say, this is it, and you may be happy. That's the kind of answer the rich young ruler wanted from Jesus and didn't get in the way he wanted to hear it. About all one can tell you is that in the Bible, the smallest percentage God ever required of anybody was 10%. The largest was 100%. I know there are special circumstances, and I'm not dealing with those. But I would say that for all of us in normal circumstances of life, the giving ought to fall somewhere between those two points. I wouldn't say this morning that all of your giving has to be done in this local congregation. There are many worthwhile causes. There are causes in the community. There are causes in the brotherhood at large. There are many areas in which you can plow back into life something of your resources other than the local church. I do believe that a sizable portion of what you give should be done in the local church. But I'm convinced that if you don't plow back at least that 10% into life, that you're not only going to impede the progress of causes you love, you're going to impede your own progress as an individual. You're going to handicap yourself spiritually, psychically. You need the process of giving and taking. I suspect that one way that 10% came about, that one way people learned the lesson so easily, and one reason God had to teach it to them as he did, may well have been in the fact that in the early history of man, man lived an agricultural existence. Those of you who know anything about seed time and harvest know that there's a fundamental law on the farm. You can't afford to eat all your seed corn. If you do, you aren't going to have any crop next year, or whatever crop you're talking about. So if you're going to have an ongoing crop, for next year's crop, you save out 10% of this year's harvest, and that will be your seed for next year. No matter how bad things become, you can't touch that because you've got to have the possibility of another crop. Same thing is true in all of life. If we're going to have another crop next year, there has to be a time of plowing back into the ground the seed from what we've received. I don't know about you, but I feel that being part of the life of this congregation has been a real blessing to me and to our family. I think we owe an awful lot here, that we've received more than we've given. It's that kind of family relationship. If that's true, about all the elders are going to be saying to us next Sunday in the Bible school hour is, exhale. You've been inhaling for a long time. You've been taking in the oxygen. Breathe out. Maybe your whole approach to life has been taking in, and you've never given yourself to the Lord in his service. Isn't it time to exhale? if you hold your breath, you're going to die. Do you need to obey the Lord's will? Would you? While we sing, to invite you.